From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, the Governor's Commission to Probe Corruption holds a second hearing. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the commission's work, and a new safety campaign is launched to stop texting and driving. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. The second public hearing held by Governor Cuomo's Commission to Probe Public Corruption featured testimony from longtime government reform groups. Many brought more evidence that they say shows potential corruption involving money in politics. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Protesters outside the hearing advocated for public campaign finance reform and displayed a wall of shame. It featured pictures and likenesses of dozens of politicians who've been indicted, arrested, convicted, or jailed in recent years. Citizen Action's Jessica Wisniewski is one of many from good government groups who testified. She says she's even more concerned about what goes on legally in state government all the time. She says corporations and other interests routinely donate large sums to politicians' campaigns.
I hope they'll use their subpoena power to absolutely put people on the stand and ask for the truth. Do you expect something in return? Was this huge check that you wrote this one night and the resulting vote the next day have a connection?
Inside, major government reform groups who testified repeated their longtime complaints about state government and presented new evidence of what they say is a pay-to-play culture between politicians and their campaign donors. The group Citizens Union issued a report on over $3 billion in the state budget in various pots of money. They say it operates as a veritable slush fund for state lawmakers to distribute to projects with little oversight and accountability. Some of the money is left over from the now-discontinued member item program for lawmakers. Dady says former state Senate leader Malcolm Smith attempted to use one of those pots of money, a fund for multimodal transportation, when he allegedly tried to bribe his way onto the Republican mayoral ticket in New York City.
Smith himself said the following, quote, "Multimodal money is outside of the budget and it's always around." Smith is not alone in his attempt to inappropriately steer member items and other pots of state funds, many of which have been used as grab bags for members to fund discretionary projects, including pet projects in their local districts.
Commissioners seemed interested in making changes. Moreland Commission co-chair Onondaga County D.A. William Fitzpatrick asked Dady that if he were given subpoena power, what would he do with it?
Where would you exercise your discretion with that subpoena power?
You know, I would follow the money.
Dady says he would track down which legislators were involved in deciding where the money goes, something he says is not made public.
I would then start to connect the dots to see who were the contributors to these legislators who have made these decisions about how to spend these public dollars.
Others testified about the campaign contribution loopholes created by the use of limited liability corporations, or LLCs, to shield the identity of donors and allow them to exceed campaign contribution limits, making New York, in the words of Common Cause's Brian Paul, a de facto unlimited contribution state. Many of the groups called for a public financing system for state offices, similar to New York City's largely successful small donor matching fund program. But when one of the commissioners asked the New York Public Interest Research Group's Bill Mahoney if that was the most important thing, Mahoney said no.
I would actually argue that the most important change overall is an independent enforcement and regulatory entity. We wholeheartedly support public financing, but any changes in the law without this would probably be rendered moot. It would be difficult to really imagine them working.
The Moreland Commission will hold at least two more hearings, then issue its recommendations in December. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Fascinating interview this week, Alan, you had with Albany County District Attorney David Soares, and he's one of the commissioners on the Moreland Act Commission that the governor set up.
David, let me tell you how this works. The district attorney is the guy who is in the Capitol, which means if some legislator turns out to be a crook, is the district attorney in Albany who is supposed to be looking at him. So out of all the DAs and all the county DAs in New York State, it is this guy who is supposed to be making decisions about who gets prosecuted and who doesn't. Now, obviously, the denizens, it's a good word, of the legislature and the governor and the rest of these guys know that David Soares could be a powerful figure. So what they try to do is to make sure that he doesn't have the resources. After all, if you're going to be a DA in New York City, you have an empire of lawyers working for you. Here, you have a handful of lawyers working for you. If you're really serious about prosecuting wrongdoers in the legislature and the politicians and the lobbyists and the rest of them, then you give David Soares a public integrity group to work with him. David Soares stands up to all of these guys all the time. I remember when Occupy Albany was here, and the governor was furious because he wanted David Soares to spend his valuable time prosecuting a bunch of kids who were exercising their First Amendment rights. David Soares said no. Whoa. Well, when the governor put together his Moreland Act Commission, he could hardly leave David Soares out of it. In my opinion, David Soares ought to have been the chairman, but okay. He brings a lot of balance for a lot of different reasons, and the fact that he is, it would have been obvious to a lot of people that if you leave out the district attorney of Albany, that jurisdiction, you really aren't serious about this. So they put him on the Moreland Act Commission, which is looking at public integrity, which is going to come out with a bunch of recommendations. And they're supposed to be looking at the relationship between money and politics. Well, Andrew Cuomo may have appointed the group, but as many people have pointed out before me, Andrew Cuomo has collected a war chest of over $29 million. Well, why did anybody give any legislator or Andrew Cuomo or anybody else money? You know why, everybody. They gave it to buy something. They want something for their money. They maybe want a player to be named later, or they may want something immediate, like some kind of entree into real estate or buildings or whatever they're looking for at that time. So along comes Soares, and he's a guy to keep your eye on because he's sitting on that Moreland Act Commission. And I know my man, Soares. He is not going to let them pull the wool over his eyes, and he is not going to let them come out with a half-baked conclusion so that the governor or anybody else can say, look at what I've got accomplished. He's going to insist that they really hold their noses to the grindstone. And I think you have what could be called a runaway Moreland Act Commission or a runaway grand jury. The people who are sitting on that Moreland Act Commission, and they have subpoena power and everything else, they are not going to roll over and play dead. At least that's my hope. We'll just have to stay tuned and see.
Alan, David Soares also pointed his finger at the Board of Elections and other officials in the state that should be looking at them.
David Soares made it clear that of all the groups that he has problems with right now, it's the nefarious doings of the people who are on the New York State Board of Elections. Now, you know, in order to be fair, they make it Democratic and Republican-led and all the rest, but they are not doing their jobs. They are not really doing the kinds of investigations that they should. Soares is furious about it and is putting the heat on them. Now, I asked him specifically, I said, well, if Andrew Cuomo went to that Board of Elections and said, do your work, people, would they do it? And Soares said, yes, they would have to because there would be a lot of pressure. So you have to look not only on performance, what they're doing, but then who their real bosses are.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Don't text and drive. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was underlining that mandate in an appearance this week at a thruway rest area as thruway authorities plan to ramp up penalties for distracted driving. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there and filed this report.
Despite a beefed-up public awareness campaign and new laws combating distracted driving, New York State troopers issued 21,500 tickets over the summer, compared to 5,000 last year. According to a recent survey by AT&T, 97% of teens across the country are aware that texting while driving can be dangerous, yet 43% admitted doing it. In New York, there have been three times more distracted driving incidents this year than 7 years ago. Governor Cuomo stopped by the New Baltimore Service Plaza to talk tough about texting.
The numbers are getting worse, not better. Why? Because as the new drivers are entering the pool, the numbers are going up. And this is a problem for all ages, all drivers. It's especially a problem for young drivers. Why? Because they are the generation of the cell phone, of the electronic device that's in their hand that they use constantly.
In 2009, Ballston Lake resident Patty Rekvica and her 12-year-old son were riding in a car that was hit by an SUV whose driver was distracted.
Thankfully, my son fared well, a few scratches, and sprained wrists. I was not as lucky. I broke my nose, fractured my neck, hurt my shoulder, and was left with a traumatic brain injury. I spent months in therapy, even learning how to speak again. To this day, I still have physical limitations. And it has been very stressful for our family. But 4 years later, as you can see, we are doing well. I have become a personal trainer and a wellness coach, not only to heal myself, but to help others along the way. After the accident, I started the DRIVE campaign, realizing we need to raise awareness and spread the word that we cannot be distracted drivers.
Thomas Madison, executive director of the New York State Thruway Authority, announced that the superhighway is rolling out a new plan to augment tough new penalties and heightened awareness about texting while driving.
New York State operates dozens of service plazas and parking areas and pullover sites along our state highways and along the entire thruway system. And today we're announcing that all of these sites will officially become texting zones. These texting zones will enable drivers to pull over and return phone calls or answer text messages in a safe, comfortable area where they don't have to take their hands off the wheel or their eyes off the road.
90 texting zones have been designated in all so drivers can stay focused on driving. Nationally, drivers are being urged to join the It Can Wait campaign, which asks drivers to put down their phones when they pick up their car keys. Go to WAMC.org to take a texting while driving test.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Members of Congress are headed back to Washington to jump back into the fire as the U.S. Senate readies a national budget that will likely be sent back to the House. Unless both houses can find a compromise by September 30th, disagreement over the debt ceiling and Affordable Care Act could bring the government to a shutdown. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard reports. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
The Republican-controlled House recently passed a budget with a provision to defund President Obama's signature Affordable Care Act. The House plan will likely not make it through the Democrat-controlled Senate. New York Congressman Bill Owens, a Democrat of the 21st District, recently predicted the odds on whether Democrats and Republicans can find an agreement in the coming days.
Well, I've been predicting it at 50-50.
Owens said that time will be short for members of Congress to strike an agreement over a Senate package before Monday's deadline.
Now they're telling us the earliest we'll vote is Saturday or Sunday. The earliest we'll vote. That means we're only going to vote on the Senate package, which means likely it'll go back to the Senate. So we're going to be playing ping pong for a while.
This week, Massachusetts 1st District Democrat Richard Neal, who has served in Congress since 1989, said that idealistic, recently elected Republicans on the far right are advocating for a dangerous result.
The imminent danger here is the following. More than 80% of the members of the House of Representatives have now served.
for such a short period of time that they don't remember the 1994 shutdown. And for those who have argued that limited experience is to be the preferred path, you're going to have a different picture of that as you watch events play out.
Republican Chris Gibson of New York's 19th District voted for the House bill passed last week that would defund the Affordable Care Act. Gibson says he believes the law is not ready to be implemented. He also says that delaying Obamacare would give Congress a chance to take another look at cuts from the sequester and find ways to reinstate federal funding to certain programs.
We've got conservatives that are looking to defund the Affordable Care Act. We have liberals that want to eliminate the sequester. And in my view, what I think is a reasonable, thoughtful, and productive compromise is if we delay the Affordable Care Act till January 2015, we lift the sequester, link it together with the Affordable Care Act, moving them both to some point in January, perhaps 31 January 2015, and work together to focus on economic growth.
But even if Congress can strike a deal over Obamacare or the sequester, the battle over the debt ceiling is also looming. Congressional Republicans are seeking to prevent an increase on the nation's $16.7 trillion borrowing limit. President Obama has said he would not accept any plan that would degrade the nation's credit rating. A similar battle in 2011 downgraded the U.S.'s Standard & Poor's credit rating from AAA to AA+. Congressman Paul Tonko of New York's 20th District, a Democrat, held a press conference this week speaking against a government shutdown and claimed that House Republicans were holding the nation hostage.
And I think to hold hostage the nation's budget or the nation's credit rating at a very critical time would not be in the best interests of this nation.
Tonko said he was hoping that as lawmakers take their votes, common sense will prevail. I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Recent changes to federal laws now mean that playgrounds must have wheelchair-accessible surfaces and equipment suitable for people living with disabilities. The changes affect all parks built or modified after March 2012. Innovation Trail's Ashley Hertzel visited one western New York town to see whether their new playground is meeting everyone's needs.
It's been a dream of ours for years and years. She's never been able to play on regular playground equipment due to her physical disabilities and safety concerns. So this is just amazing. She can come and just be a regular kid and enjoy everything that typical kids can enjoy.
On a cool autumn day, Amanda Malloy is pushing her 12-year-old daughter Peyton on a chair swing. Fortunately, the chair is designed to keep people of all sizes safely buckled in while they swing.
Do you want to go higher?
Yeah.
Faster?
Yeah.
Peyton and her family have visited Kiwanis Park in the town of Batavia at least once a week since it was upgraded this past May. Before that, Mom Amanda says Peyton had to stay back and watch her cousins play. But now,
friends with disabilities, friends without disabilities can come here and all play together. We've had her and a bunch of her friends here, and the moms and dads just kind of hang out and stand back and watch. And our eyes are filled with tears because we're just so happy that they can play like typical kids.
Shelley Politico is the director of development at the Genesee ARC, a nonprofit group that advocates for people with disabilities. Politico says the inclusive playground goes beyond the federal guidelines.
Someone could propel their own wheelchair, or if they use a walker, or if they have trouble walking. It's very well laid out that it makes it accessible for anybody in our community.
The playground was built by volunteers and funded through the municipality's reserve fund and donations. The new equipment is custom built and colorful. Politico says it's crucial for people with disabilities to have a safe outdoor space to play.
There's a piece that's over there they can lie on and pull themselves through with their hands, and it's got these large metal rolling balls that go up and down their back and down their legs. In children with autism, that type of sensory input is very helpful, therapeutic, but it's done in a fun way. So the child without a disability that's waiting in line to get on behind them can do the same type of activity, and it doesn't make it look like, oh, it was just set up for a child that's disabled. Any child can use it.
Dr. Kate DeBalove is the chair in the Department of Inclusive Childhood Education at Nazareth College. She says accessible playgrounds offer children necessities important to their development.
One of the ways that we develop confidence is through being able to do things successfully, independently. And so as we think about an inclusive playground and some of the play design concepts, inclusive playgrounds include things that have multiple levels of challenges so that all children are able to have success, be able to have fun, and some independence.
Tom Lichtenthal, the Town of Batavia Highway Superintendent, worked on the design of the park. He says the playground includes a feature that people in a wheelchair might not have used before, a swing.
We did a lot of research behind that wheelchair swing to see what was the risk involved in it. Risk was very low. So the swing itself, what you do is you basically take the wheelchair, you roll them up onto a platform, you strap them in, chain them in, and then they swing just like a normal swing.
Lichtenthal says the town's foot traffic has tripled since the playground opened. Many people have come from all over upstate New York to visit the park. He suggests other municipalities make their parks inclusive as well.
The appreciation that we saw made all the additional effort that it takes. And it really wasn't that much more effort, but the reward was 100 times greater than the effort that you put in. So I would not even hesitate to do something like this again.
In the future, Tom Lichtenthal says they plan to add more accessible equipment to the playground at Kiwanis Park. Peyton Malloy's suggestion is a slide. In Buffalo, I'm Ashley Hertzel for the Innovation Trail.
With this week's Legislative Notebook, I'm David Gustina. In the headlines, electricity and gas utility National Grid says it has agreed to pay more than $6 million to workers in New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island who waited months to receive compensation for work performed after Superstorm Sandy. More than 8,500 employees in those states will receive lump sum payments of $750. Company spokeswoman Jackie Berry blames the problem on a computerized payroll system that went online as scheduled just days into the chaotic recovery from the late October storm. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says he reached the $4.8 million settlement with National Grid. The company has agreed not to pass the costs on to ratepayers. New York State officials say they suspect test takers cheated on hundreds of tests to operate the most vulnerable vehicles on the road, from trucks hauling hazardous materials to school buses. And 8 commercial drivers have been charged so far. 19 suspects, including 3 security guards, were arraigned and pleaded not guilty to charges linked to what officials say is an elaborate scheme to obtain commercial driver's licenses with purchased test replies. State Inspector General Catherine Leahy Scott said Thursday the arrests represent the tip of the iceberg, but investigators don't know yet exactly how many drivers might be on the road with criminally obtained licenses. The investigation was first reported by the New York Daily News. New York voters will decide November 5th whether to let the judges on the state's highest court keep handing down rulings and making case law until they turn 80 years old. 7 Court of Appeals judges appointed to 14-year terms now must retire the year they turn 70. Approval of the referendum would postpone mandatory retirement for 4 judges currently on the bench. A spokesman says the former leader of New York's Senate, who's facing a second federal fraud trial in December, is recovering from surgery after having a cancerous tumor removed from his kidney. Senator Joseph Bruno, now 84, was acquitted in 2009 of 5 counts and convicted of 2 others that were overturned on appeal. He has denied wrongdoing and says he had outside business interests like most of New York's part-time lawmakers. Prosecutors have refiled those 2 charges against the Rensselaer County Republican, once considered one of the 3 most powerful officials in Albany. They say he accepted more than $400,000 from a businessman for helping with state grants. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1339. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at the same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.